there, Tony Allen with you for A Country Breakfast. We hear a lot about developing Northern Australia. It's big country, but attempts at big farming often don't work in the top end. Seems it's better to start small.
The Vietnamese growers that we have here have come here about 30 years ago with no support from government, with hardly any language, and with some funding out of the markets, were able to establish small plots of ground and grow over time. And while one or two farmers might fail and fall away, there would be another one to replace them.
How to succeed in farming the North, later in the program. But first, let's check the rural news headlines this week with Kath McAloon. And Kath, halal certification was bad news for a yogurt company this week.
That's right, a South Australian dairy company ended up dropping its halal campaign after it was the target of a Facebook campaign about anti-halal. The Fleurier Milk and Yogurt Company pulled out of halal certification and they lost a $50,000 deal to supply the Emirates airline because of the pressure they were under on social media.
Yes, now this campaign was claiming that money spent on halal certification was being channeled into terrorism.
That's right, and the certifiers have said that's not the case. In the meantime, though, this company is calling for the federal government to help them strengthen social media laws. They say that that there are other companies in similar positions that have been through this sort of ordeal, and the company's marketing and sales manager, Nick Hutchinson, says they want to see the laws tightened.
If these social media laws can be tightened, automatically the problem goes. If these anti-halal sites are shut down, the one person that emailed me, she can have her say, but she can't reach out to 100,000 followers and get them onto a company at once.
And what's the group say that was campaigning for a boycott of halal products?
They've been unapologetic about the plight of the yogurt company. Kiralee Smith founded this group called Halal Choices, who are behind the anti-halal campaign, and she claims that the certifiers are extorting money from food companies.
Well, there isn't any problem, but the consumer should have a choice. If they want to fund Islamic schools or Islamic mosques, then I should know where my money is going for those things. And I don't think that that's a clear choice because it is not on most labels. You know, Nestle, Cadbury's, Sanitarium, they're all paying these fees, but you're not aware of it because it's not on the label.
Now, I understand that Kiralee Smith was not really able to prove that money was being channelled into terrorism, so where is it going?
Well, one of the largest halal certifiers in Australia is the Islamic Coordinating Council, and they say that those claims by Kiralee Smith are a political stunt to distort Islam. The chief abattoir auditor with the council is Jafar Mohammed, and he says all the money from certification goes to good causes.
Certification is not very expensive to the meatworks. It's only 1%, and it's always used to assist the Muslim community in Australia to perform their religious duties, like in the mosques and schools and social life.
Well, this week we saw demonstrations on the stairs of Melbourne Town Hall for an emergency Senate hearing. What was that about?
Yeah, there was quite dramatic scenes and quite emotional testimony going on inside. There's been an urgent meeting called of this Senate hearing looking into failed managed investment schemes, particularly the Timbercorp business. And the chairman of this Senate committee fears that people will have their houses foreclosed on them if victims aren't offered help. You will remember that Timbercorp, which managed different agricultural investments, but particularly forestry, collapsed back in 2009, and now hundreds of investors have already been served with writs over the company's debt. An emergency Senate hearing was held this week, and it was investigating particularly the ANZ Bank's role in the debacle. There was a big turnout at the Melbourne Town Hall with people waving placards that were sort of attacking the ANZ and their role in it. The committee chair, Senator Sam Dastyari, says thousands of investors feel hurt and angry because while the ANZ announced a $7.3 billion profit last week, these investors risk losing their homes.
What we now risk is the largest ever mass foreclosure on homes and families that we've seen in this country. Up to 3,000 families risk losing the family home, and right now there is 70 different writs being issued every week by the liquidator.
And Senator Dastyari says that the case strengthens the need for a royal commission into the Australian banking system.
Yes, and that was the view of the multi-party Senate committee, but the government has yet to agree to that. Well, interesting story about fresh apples this week.
Yeah, what does make an apple constitute a fresh apple? And Coles has found itself in hot water over how it was advertising apples. In a television ad, Coles was describing Tasmanian apples as being fresh spring fruit, but that wasn't the case. They'd been in storage for several months, and they got a complaint from someone from Tasmania who said, well, my apple tree's been dormant for months, so you can't have fresh spring Tasmanian apples. Coles says it won't run the commercials again. Fiona Jolly is from the Advertising Standards Bureau, and she says that most people understand that fruit is stored in cool rooms for a period of time and it's still fresh, but she says it was the word spring that they had a problem with.
The reference to spring fruit makes it a very strong inference that the fruit is spring fresh fruit. And in the board's view, reasonable members of the community would consider that spring fresh meant picked in spring, not picked in autumn and kept in cold storage for several months.
We had an announcement this week, the findings of the review of the Rural Financial Counselling Service. Now, this was a pretty controversial issue because there had been recommendations that the special counselling service for farmers in drought should be dumped and they should use normal counselling services.
Well, the review has found that the program can, in some cases, be inconsistent and ineffective. It hasn't recommended that it be dumped entirely. It says it should continue, but with a 20% funding cut, and it should also have more part-time and casual staff is the recommendation. It's a program that provides free advice to farmers and fishermen as well as small rural businesses that face financial hardship. And the report also recommended that all states should move towards having just one rural financial counselling service provider. At the moment, it's different in different states. And Chair of the National Rural Advisory Council, Mick Keogh, says there's still strong demand for the service in some areas, but he says the skills and professionalism of the boards and the pay that they receive does vary significantly.
Some of those services have evolved and become much more professional to meet that requirement, whereas some are still probably at a simpler level and haven't really upgraded the skills and the personnel to reflect that change in sophistication of farm businesses.
And Claire de Kock is the Executive Officer of Victoria's North Central Service with the Rural Financial Counselling Program. And she says budget cuts don't make sense, particularly at the moment, because demand for the service is heavy.
It's actually on the increase at the moment, with Western Victoria now being declared drought affected. And the expectation is that the north of the state will actually follow over the summer period. And we can expect a huge increase between now and, say, March.
And I did notice the Agriculture Minister, Barnaby Joyce, expressing confidence in the service, so it really be a matter for the government as to whether they do make those changes, cut the budget a bit, and employ more casuals. Seems to be the way a lot of businesses go these days.
Indeed.
Speaking of business, we had the G20 in Brisbane this week. Down the other end of the Pacific Highway in Sydney, they had the F20. Now, what was that about?
Now, the F20 stands for the Food 20, and it draws together farmers and other people involved in agriculture and food businesses. It was organised by Rabobank, which is the world's largest lender to agriculture. And Rabobank claims that farmers aren't being invited into any serious debate about the impending food, water and population crisis, and it says governments are not seriously addressing the decline in farm productivity down to zero growth. And executive board member with Rabobank, Barry Martin, says that world farming will require at least 2% productivity growth in yields, and that is just not happening.
I'm now already 25 years in this industry, and I have not seen really major expansions in outreach. New really top agricultural universities. Because if you want to increase the research, you really need also to train people in this area.
Well, as well as the G20 this week, we had the APEC meeting, and the big announcement from that was an agreement by the USA and China to reduce their emissions. Now, they're huge emission makers, of course. So isn't that bad for Australian exports of things like coal?
You would think so, but a prominent economist actually believes that Australia could benefit from this decision and it could be positive for the Australian coal and natural gas industries. Saul Eslake is from the Bank of America Merrill Lynch, and he says as China transitions to more renewable energies, it will still need to use fossil fuels. And he says high quality, lower emissions Australian coal is likely to be more in demand, as is our gas.
By substituting Australian coal for its own coal production, another possibility is that China could use more LNG and less coal and other fossil fuels. There's an opportunity for Australia to sell more LNG to China than it's currently doing.
And a very sad thing to finish this week. If you look at your average ute in Australia, it has a Conargo pub sticker on it. And Conargo is a little town near Deniliquin in the New South Wales Riverina, but it's famous for the pub, but the pub is no more.
The pub is no longer. The authorities are investigating a fire that broke out there during the week and destroyed the iconic Conargo Hotel. It's just near Deniliquin in the Riverina area. Jade Clough is a resident of Conargo, and she was there and saw the building engulfed in flames.
Everyone's really devastated about it. Like, the whole community came last night and we're all there till like 12 and onwards. It's a few sad faces and stuff. It's actually a very like iconic pub in the Riverina and all over Australia. Like, people stop in here and get the Conargo sticker and stuff like that. So yeah, it's a shame to all of New South Wales and Australia.
And they will be crying into their beers at the Denny Ute muster later in the year.
Sure to be.
They've lost their stickers, but they'll still have their Kelpies. I understand they are going to try and rebuild it, though, and they've started a fund already.
Good news. Thanks, Tony.
Thanks, Kath. Rural Reporter is next.
Did you know that right underneath the heart of Sydney's CBD, there's a lake? It's over a kilometre long and 6 metres deep in parts, right next to the City Circle railway line in an unfinished tunnel. Rumour has it that the army sends troops down there to train in complete darkness.
Hello.
And there's a huge albino eel which pops up when you least expect it. Off track. Today at 1.
I'm Tony Allen with you for A Country Breakfast this morning on RN. It's time to join our rural reporters. This week, the wool shed isn't the male domain it once was, as young women opt for a career in the industry, and Pilbara locals look to native plant species to vegetate their gardens. It might not attract the crowds that gather at the National War Memorial, but the small rural community of Bungabi still stops to remember Armistice Day. And we're off to the opera, the Phantom of the Opera that's being staged in regional South Australia. Rock and roll singer Ron Hay has put his pub gigs behind him to play the man behind the mask.
It's the difference between singing Masquerade in the Australian type twang to Masquerade in that very sort of what we call Italian vowels.
The Whyalla Players tackling one of the world's great musicals later in the program. But first today, the wool industry and the campaign to get more women working in the sheds.
So what we're looking at is a sheep that was shorn this time last year.
Yeah, yep. And crushed in about April.
The wool shed isn't the male domain it once was. In Australia today, there's more than 100 registered female shearers, and 80% of wool handlers are women too. So what attracts them to an industry that involves such hot, sweaty and back-breaking work? Hello, I'm Larissa Smith, and the answer might lie with a group of women I've met today.
If we could just move around the other side of the wool table now. Sarah's going to try the place.
They're all involved with or want to be involved in the wool industry as classes, shearers, even as university graduates with business management degrees. And I've caught up with them at the Riverina TAFE College in Wagga Wagga in southwestern New South Wales.
Fiona Rawley, I'm a wool classing trainer here at Primary Industry Centre.
So it could have been crushed just before shearing with 12 months wool. It could have been crutched. And that time's in his management too, the time of the year.
As a trainer, I have a lot of young girls in my class. They are desperately looking for role models and mentors as an entry point into the wool industry. There's definitely people interested. It's just a difficult industry to find your way into. So that's what I'm trying to look at, is making that pathway easier and accessible for young people.
And what was it like for you getting into wool classing?
Well, I started wool classing a long time ago and a lot's changed since then. I guess I was a bit of a novelty when I first started and there weren't many female wool handlers, and now it is definitely the norm. Female wool handlers and female wool classes are recognised as having that attention to detail that's very desirable. For me personally, I loved the physical challenge of working in the sheds, and I also liked the freedom that working in the sheds gave me.
Shana Stevens. I first got into shearing 2 years ago, 16 years old. I started just before I was 14. I started at just our home. It's towards Lake Jellygo from With Ali. From then on, I went to shear Outback and learnt for 2 weeks there.
Would you say that you're fairly young to be starting shearing?
Some people say, but I've got the right technique, I think. So it's been a lot easier for me, but a lot of people at my age are probably a bit smaller, like, in building that, so that's probably been the only thing that's helped me out.
How did your back go in the first year?
Yeah, not good at all. It was really bad, actually. I nearly died, but after that it was good.
So how did you improve your technique?
I slept a lot and just kept going back into it. I was using the back brace, and it was more about just learning the technique and where your feet had to actually stand. If you didn't move your feet, you twisted your back, and that was when it was the worst time of the pain. But now that you're a bit used to where your feet are going to go and all that sort of stuff, your back's curved when you're bending over. But yeah, it's good now, just now that I've got my technique right.
When you turn up to a shearing shed and you work on other teams, do you see many women in these teams?
No, this is the first girl shearer that I've seen in here today. I'm normally in a team with boys. The only time you see a girl is if they're a rousey or they're sweeping or something like that.
Would you like to see more?
Yeah, I would actually. No one in Australia criticises against them, so don't see why they shouldn't or why they should be scared of doing it. It's good. You meet a lot of new people.
Crossbreds themselves, the fleeces are more round shaped, so they tend to go on a round table better.
My name's Casey Ennett, so I'm 21 years of age and I'm studying agriculture business management at CSU. I was originally from Cootamundra. My family farm. We sold up a while back and I was in town all my schooling life, and I've nearly finished my agriculture business degree. I've got 4 subjects to go next year, so looking to move into a job halfway through next year. What interests me in particular is probably how exciting the sheep and wool industry is at the moment. So I'm moving into the wool industry at a time where it's changing a lot from our traditional merino to our dual purpose sheep for climate change. So it's really an interesting time for me to move into something like that with the knowledge I've accumulated from university.
Is there competition for sheep and wool consultancy?
Not really, to be quite honest. Sheep and wool consultancy is a bit of a niche field for university students. I feel as though a lot of people are moving into cropping and cattle. Yeah, sheep and wool is actually, I'm kind of out on my own in my university degree, so it might be easy for me to find something actually.
The neck will fall over the rest of the fleece.
A job in the wool industry, we often see that it could just be getting formal training at university or at a TAFE. It can be as simple as the fact that you get a job in the wool store sorting dags. That can be the entry level to becoming a wool broker. So girls need to be courageous and confident that any job in the wool industry is a stepping stone towards a career.
From sorting dags, how far can you go?
A young girl that I know, I can see her overseas buying wool for an Italian mill and in the fashion trade. That's what I can see her doing. You know, from doing her wool classing stencil with me, going through to working in Milan sourcing wools. How fabulous would that be? The wool industry is quite small. So if we do have globally, and if we do have these trained, talented people, well, it is a global industry. It's not just going to be working here in a shed. Our wool's exported. We need people with talents and technical knowledge overseas as well.
You need to find the 2 back legs, because that is what you hold on to when you throw it.
Well, it's all about
remembering people have gone to war. If you mean why Bungabi, well, it doesn't really matter where it is. It's just as significant whether it's in Martin Place, Sydney, or the middle of nowhere in Bungabi with the wind farms looking over us.
We're at Bungabi, a tiny dot on the windswept Monaro Plain, about 50 kilometres northwest of Bombala in southern New South Wales. Hello, I'm Michael Kavanagh, and while it might not attract the huge crowds of Martin Place in Sydney or the National War Memorial in Canberra, that doesn't mean today's Remembrance Day ceremony isn't a significant event for this small rural community. Chris Walls is a Cooma-based lawyer. Every year he travels out to Bungabi to play his trumpet.
What I love about Bungabi is that they get a fantastic percentage of the community turning up. I mean, I've been here some years where there's been 40 people, and they're a real community, and a lot of this service is about community.
To get up and play both The Last Post, Ravelli, and then a hymn and Advance Australia Fair, they're very well known. What sort of pressure is on you to perform and do it well?
Well, there's no pressure on me. If I mucked it up terribly, everyone would be wonderfully forgiving because that's the sort of people they are here. So there's no pressure. And, you know, it's all about the occasion and remembering people have been to war. So it's not for me and it's not for them as an audience. It's the occasion. It's Remembrance Day.
The flag is flying at half-mast. About 20 people have gathered here beside the corrugated iron memorial hall to listen as Anglican priest Jenny Roberts leads the service. Vietnam veteran and retired farmer Wes Van Dyne has come to live in the district after leaving the army. He's heavily involved in organising today's ceremony.
Well, we have a very small community here. You know, you'd be pushing to get 20, 25 people. Every year we have the Armistice Day memorial service, and half of that population comes along, and they come because of the respect and the people that have actually left here from Bungabi to go to the First World War and the Second World War. And it's only a very small place, and you've got to take your hats off to the community of that size to contribute so much.
Wes, you yourself are a Vietnam veteran. What does it mean to you when you are standing there in the front of everybody playing a fairly major role in today's service?
I'm very honoured to be able to do what I do. People in civilian life, they sort of look at you as you know, someone that's very important in the community. And to some extent, they're probably right, but I don't sort of feel that because I'm the only veteran in the area. I take it as a responsibility to keep the memorial meetings going, and it's important to the community, and I'm very proud to do what I do.
Beside the hall stands a 2-metre-high stone plinth. It records the names of all of those from the district who enlisted to fight in both World Wars. Inside a nearby shed is a kitchen and meeting room. In a glass cabinet on a wall is 2 honour roll boards, which also list those who fought in both World Wars. A gold asterisk beside the name denominates those who didn't return. Jeanette Casillas married into a local farming family. Their name features prominently on the memorial stone. Your brother-in-law went away to war, and looking at the honour roll here, both for the First World War and the Second World War, what strikes it about a small community like this is the same families involved in both wars. Did the families talk about it much in the years that you've been farming after the war was over?
Talk about it much. Well, I suppose I live on the property where there was 4 sons enlisted, and they were distant relatives. 2 returned, 2 didn't. They were victims. Most of the people on the honour roll, 90% of them would be relatives, distant cousins, etc. Yeah.
What's the story about November 15, 1915, and enlistment, and also the words of a minister?
There was a recruitment drive at the hall, and I think it was a sports day, and they raised £100 for the war effort and recruited soldiers to enlist that day, and I think there was 4 or 5 enlisted that particular day.
And what's the story about a minister exhorting people to join up?
Oh yes, I believe that was the story that one the ministers told in the recruitment drive, that there was their one-way ticket to heaven if they enlisted.
Bungabi local Jeanette Cassilis ending that report on the Remembrance Day service from Michael Kavanagh. Still to come from our rural reporters, the Whyalla Players bring Phantom of the Opera to life in regional South Australia, and Pilbara locals look to native plants to green up their gardens.
I guess I find it very frustrating, you know, because you do see these beautiful mulla mullas going on the side of the road, the little pink gum farinas, you know, the sturt does appear, and you go, why can't I go to the shops and buy it? Like, it's native, it grows here, it's hot here, there's very little nutrients, and we're shipping these plants up from all over Australia that aren't suitable. And you know, you go plant something, it dies, or it's got to be irrigated every single day, and you get these huge water bills. Why can't I just go buy something local?
Gardening in Western Australia's Pilbara region can be a real challenge. Between the heat, the dust, the soils, and the odd cyclone to boot, it's hardly surprising that many people here simply opt for gravel gardens. But one group wants to change that and bring native flowers like mulla mulla and Sturt's desert pea into everyone's backyard. Hi there, I'm Lucy Bell. The Greening Australia group thinks there's potential in the commercial propagation of native Pilbara species, especially for use in the region's mine revegetation programs. Today, they're holding a special workshop in Port Hedland to teach local community and Indigenous groups how to collect and store native seeds.
My name's Pip Short. I'm the Community Projects Coordinator for the Pilbara with Greening Australia, based out of Port Hedland. We have been lucky enough to organise a seed collecting workshop just to show different people a bit more about the native plants, a bit more of the different techniques to do with seed collecting, some of the gear you might need, the things you need to be careful for, you know, whether plants are poisonous, toxic, and even just how particularly Indigenous groups might be able to get some profit out of this. So, you know, if you're living out on country and you can go collect seed, Ninnathana, and that will buy it off you.
Pip, you had an incredible collection of some of the different seeds for people to have a look at here today. Everything from sort of feathery seeds to enormous nuts and fruits, pods, tiny little seeds, you know, a tenth of the size of your fingernail.
They're all ones that are from our Pilbara native plant book. They have different dispersal methods, you know, they have different ways that they needed to be treated. Some of them apparently need to get eaten by an emu, which is why there's a decline in that species, because all the emus are gone. So it's amazing how, you know, specifically adapted these native plants are, and you can see that in their seeds.
Keith Smith is running today's seed collecting workshop. He's dressed in high vis and sorts through piles and piles of Ziploc bags holding seeds with long botanical names on them.
The Pilbara is blessed with diversity. We've got typically the mulla mullas, very spectacular. Most of the tourists love to see these. Cockroach bushes, these are quite common throughout the Pilbara as well. The idea of the discussion, I guess, today is to try and get more of these things growing back in local gardens and local parks.
Why is it that we currently don't see very much in the way of native plants?
I guess it can be a mindset where people are used to sort of the more European species, possibly also some issues with seed supply. I mean, the seed collecting profession is a different one. So the supply has been an issue, and getting the diversity in that supply.
One of Keith's students today is Dorothy.
See myself starting off working in a nursery, but down the future track I want to work out in the open on the land. My name is Dorothy Papertook. I'm from Port Hedland. It's South Hedland virtually, and I'm doing the horticultural course at the Pundamurra TAFE.
Tell me, what sorts of things have you got out of today?
Well, I learnt about the native trees and seeds and nuts that grows here, and how to propagate them and what sort of treatment to use to germinate them for the next season, for when we ever need to grow some more seeds.
Have you done much seed collection traditionally?
As a child, I did with my father. I grew up, I never did anymore, and then basically I never ever thought I'd do this sort of course in life. And now that I'm doing it, I find it's really energizing, spiritual and healthy, and helping the land back. And if I can learn a bit more and hang in there and know a bit more about it, then yeah, down the track I'll be looking at myself, set my own little collection of seeds and propagating and giving back to the business.
The seeds being collected today will take quite a while to grow into mature plants, but Pip Short from Greening Australia hopes it won't be too long before more native plants become commercially available.
We've actually got a whole heap of seeds, and we've got some of the guys who are here today, some of the different nursery groups, propagating them for us. So hopefully in the coming months and into next year, there will be local native Pilbara plants available to the public, so people can go and buy a mulla mulla, they can go buy an acacia, they can go buy a senna, and they can have these beautiful water-wise native plants that attract birds, they attract insects, they make your garden look great, and they will direct seed themselves. You know, you buy one plant, hopefully your garden will be gone for the next 20, 100 years.
It's not a sound you'd expect to hear rise up from the dusty red mining city of Whyalla in South Australia. But an idea many could have brushed off as a phantom concept has unmasked a pool of local singing and theatrical talent that's ready to prove itself.
Phantom of the Opera is a bit different to singing Led Zeppelin and a bit of Chisel and those sorts of songs. So,
hello, I'm Lauren Waldhuter. Ron Hay comes from the Whyalla Players Theatre Group. He first floated the idea of staging this ambitious musical back in 2012. And 2 years on and $100,000 later, it's a reality. Ron's the show's producer and is also the man behind the mask on stage. Playing the lead role of the Phantom has taken him away from his rock and roll roots and into a world which could be described as a little more refined.
It's a difference between singing Masquerade in the Australian type twang to Masquerade in that very sort of what we call Italian vowels. So it's been a real dramatic change, and for me personally, I haven't actually sung with a rock and roll band for the last 9 months.
Was that a conscious decision? You actually had to stop to train yourself?
Yes, it was actually, so that I could actually change my voice pattern.
But you don't mind it though?
Do not mind it one little bit. It's been fantastic.
The show is really a musical about opera, set at the Paris Opera House in the late 1800s. It tells the story of a man thought to be a phantom who lives in the basement of the house and becomes infatuated with one of the main singers. It's not a simple show to take to the stage. In fact, it's cost the Whyalla Players more than $100,000. The complex sets and costumes were hired from Melbourne and brought to Whyalla in two 13-tonne containers.
Is it one of the greats?
I think you have to say it is one of the greats. When you read all the literature and all the write-ups, it's probably one of the most, if not best, musical and most popular. The songs stay with you in your mind forever.
Why can't the past just die?
An hour up the road from Whyalla in Port Augusta, Imala Kanine has spent hours singing the part of Christine in her lounge room. The 17-year-old, who is sharing the lead role with 16-year-old Caitlin McKenzie, has been juggling rehearsals with Year 12 study. She says singing is a new love.
I only really discovered a few years ago that I could sing well, but I've never really sung the range or the style that Christine has to sing. She has to sing like more than two octaves. No, almost three octaves, I think, in one song. Yeah, and she's on stage the most out of all the characters. Like, you think the Phantom's the main character, but really, it's Christine.
So you're also juggling Year 12 at the moment. So what has your life looked like over the last 4 months or so?
Stressing out. Two of my performances, I have exams that morning. They let me not do the performance the night before my exam because, you know, that wouldn't be that good. But I think rehearsals have been really good because it's kind of a time when I can go and just forget about Year 12.
Education has been a big part of the Whyalla Players' preparation. In the early stages of production, the group approached the State Opera Company's CEO, Tim Sexton, for support.
My initial thought was, what on earth are you thinking? It's actually really, really tricky to put on. We were up there about 2 years ago with an opera gala that we performed in the Middleback Theatre, and that's when Ron Hay approached me and said, we've got this idea. What do you reckon?
Tim Sexton became involved with the audition process, and his early trepidation turned to optimism. He believed there was enough talent in the region to put on the show. And since then, Mr. Sexton has been flying up to Whyalla every few weeks to help with musical development. But he says the company's support has been provided at a distance.
It's not our production. You know, we're not sending up scores of singers and taking the place of local people at all. I'll be conducting the production, but we're providing some orchestral players to fill in the gaps. But it's very much a Whyalla Players show, and they are to be commended. It's really come up extremely well.
How often does the State Opera Company offer this level of assistance to a community theatre group like the Whyalla Players?
Now, that's a very good question, Lauren. We don't, actually. This is our first. But there is a really good need to spend a bit more time in each of the communities, find out what is really there, what talents and opportunities exist, what opportunities don't exist. And we're not the State Opera Company of Adelaide, we're the State Opera of South Australia. It's important that we service and find ways to engage with people all across South Australia.
When the lights go down and the curtain comes up, the Whyalla Players will be out to prove that the arts can be a powerful force in regional South Australia. Ron Hay says there has been some doubt.
A lot of people said, you know, like, so how are you going to do this? Is this the real Phantom of the Opera? Yes, it is the real Phantom of the Opera, with the Phantom's lair, the candelabras, the boat, all the other trimmings, and the costumes and the set look actually very professional, very fantastic. And I think that's where people will see the real difference in this production in terms of what Whyalla Players Community Theatre Group is able to put on.
Strains of the music of Phantom of the Opera, ending that report from Lauren Waldhuter. And Lauren reports the show was a great success, attracting crowds from right across South Australia. So well done to all those involved in such an ambitious musical. This is A Country Breakfast on RN. I'm Tony Allen.
Australians trust ABC News. Did you know abc.net.au/news delivers?
Local news relevant to where you live.
Australia's best live coverage as news breaks here and overseas.
abc.net.au/news with excellent interactive features and in-depth analysis.
It's Australia's most active news service on social media. ABC News is for everyone.
And it's free.
abc.net.au/news.
While big business investment in North Australian agriculture has come and gone decade after decade, it's the minor farmers who've stayed the course. Small crops of fruits, Asian vegetables and, of course, herds of cattle have been built on by several generations. At the Food Futures Conference in Darwin recently, farmers met to discuss how new agricultural ventures in the Northern Territory, Western Australia and Northern Queensland could survive. The main message was that starting small and gradually getting big is the best way to succeed. Lucy Barber has more.
One of the more recent and modern messages in agriculture has been to get big or get out. But Chief Executive of the Northern Territory Farmers Association, Grant Fenton, says that doesn't necessarily apply when you're in the top end.
Well, if you look at some of the failures in Northern Ag, there's been some big corporate farms that have come up here and tried to set up and failed for a whole range of reasons. And those, if we look at the one of the great business models for success here in the Northern Territory, for instance, the Vietnamese growers that we have here have come here about 30 years ago with no support from government, with hardly any language, and with some funding out of the markets, were able to establish small plots of ground and grow over time. And while one or two farmers might fail and fall away, there would be another one to replace them. So those small growers have developed into such a position now that they represent around $30 million worth of Asian vegetables and about $30 to $40 million worth of mango production. So that's what we would say is starting small and growing big.
John Howard is the chief executive of the Peanut Company of Australia. He knows what failure can be like. In 2007, his company invested millions of dollars to establish a commercial peanut crop just outside of Katherine. But plans for large-scale production were abandoned and the property was sold 2 years ago.
We probably went the other philosophy where we went too big and hence the business issues that we had with it. But what we have shown is there is a way to grow peanuts, and we think they do work up here.
How much can peanut production expand and into which areas?
A third of our intake already comes from the Atherton Tablelands, just to the west of Cairns. So in that northern temperate type climate, we've also had properties outside of Katherine where the business venture didn't work, but we did show that peanuts can be grown there. We've got demand for Australian peanuts that is greater than what we currently produce. It's a tiny crop in Australia, only 30 to 35,000 tonnes. One of the beauties of peanuts in that start small and growing is you don't need large amounts of off-farm capability to be able to grow peanuts. And the example here is, say, sugar cane, where you need a sugar mill. So it's a very large investment.
The peanut industry is looking ahead and building on the lessons it's learnt. John Howard says local knowledge, whether it's of the crops, the climate or the community, is crucial. Director of the Institute of Environment and Livelihoods at Charles Darwin University, Andrew Campbell, agrees.
It's really important up here. You've got massive variability within the year between this, you know, guaranteed drought every dry season and then guaranteed floods almost every wet season. You've got, even in Darwin, 1.5 metres more evaporation than rainfall. So it's a really tough gig doing agriculture up here at any scale. And I think before scaling up, you've got to know you've got a really robust model. There's a critical message today that you do need enough capital to be able to survive a crook year or two. But the idea of the great big mega project, the cavalry coming over the hill that's going to save the whole economy, I think that's what's in question here, and I agree with those who are questioning that model.
David Menzel grows melons, pumpkins and legumes in Kununurra in far northwestern Australia, but it's taken years and years of hard work and learning. He says he had no choice but to start small.
We started in the Ord, moving from Victoria, knowing nothing about growing in the north, and worked for a farm for a couple of years, gained some experience, then got the opportunity to start in a very small scale with our partners. And yeah, it's a lot cheaper to learn on other people's money than it is on your own. So yeah, to get that slow, affordable start so that a small mistake doesn't bankrupt you.
So do you think if you're a business looking to develop in the north, you have to have deep pockets from the outset if you do want to start big?
It seems that's the way, especially if you're starting from nothing, to get through approvals processes and to go from nothing to a business. It's only large corporates at the moment, so I'm really interested in trying to find some ways, and I know we've got a good speaker who will give us some examples from Brazil, where they have started from like a pastoral lease cattle station operation and moved into farming with utilising skill sets, bringing in people that can start small and grow into a business. So I'm really looking forward to that.
That speaker was Brazilian cattleman Rodolfo Vaz de Cavalo, a fourth generation cattle producer who's diversified his business to now include farming 10,000 hectares of soybeans and corn. At the time, some people in the industry thought he was crazy, but Rodolfo says it's been important to spread the economic risk and to start small.
Productivity only with cattle, even with improved pastures, is pretty hard. And I had some pretty good soils for agriculture. And we started doing little by little, slowly but surely. A few people would even mock us, it's true, because it's big traditional cattle people. We started with very small agriculture, some 200 hectares for 3 or 4 years. And people said, why are you doing that? I said, well, because we got to learn. It's easier to learn small, make a few small mistakes than make big mistakes. So we started off small. And throughout the years, prepared our own personnel, trained them, as opposed to just going to the market. So we ended up well with more than 10,000 hectares. So when the grain prices are too low, we can extra feed the cattle, which gives us a better yield, and vice versa. The biggest companies in the world, Bunge, Cargill, ADM, they buy us. The soybeans is mainly for export. Some of the maize is export, but mostly is used in Brazil for animal feed, basically poultry and pork. The big companies do that. So if you guys start producing a lot of something, the big guys are going to come and get it because they need the product.
Brazilian cattleman and crop farmer Rodolfo Vaz de Carvalho, ending Lucy Barber's report from the Food Futures Conference in Darwin. And one crop that more farmers in the top end could be growing soon is pineapples. That's because the largest pineapple producer in Australia has expanded to the Northern Territory. Pinata Farms has been growing pineapples in Queensland for decades, and it's expecting to harvest its first NT crop near Darwin in February. Matt Brand spoke to the managing director, Gavin Skerr, and got him to explain the company's plan for the territory.
Yeah, we've been looking at growing pineapples in the territory for a few years now. And I guess the decision was made about 18 months ago when it was the end of three very wet summers over in Queensland was the impetus for us to come and make the decision to grow here in the territory. We've always felt that the climate that is here in the territory would be good for, particularly Darwin, would be good for pineapple. After three very wet summers where we've had poor yields because of delayed planting, water logging, etc. in Queensland, we bit the bullet and come over here, and at this stage looking very good.
Yeah, so you've got a pineapple crop in the ground, gearing up for a harvest next year. How's it all looking?
It's looking very good, to be honest. We planted the first crop in October last year, so they're just over 12 months old, 13 months old. They will harvest sort of February through to April in 2015, so a few months' time. They're all flowering now, looking very good. We had a fairly wet season here in Darwin, and then a fairly long, cool winter, and that certainly tests pineapple. And they've come through that a lot better than we expected, to be honest. So at this stage, looking pretty positive.
How many hectares do you have?
At this stage, we've only got 10 hectares each year that we're planting. So the plan is to do, the plan was to do three lots of 10 hectares a year apart just to see how it goes. Because it's gone so well, we'll probably put another 10 hectares in about April next year now. And move forward from there. So
where are the markets for these Northern Territory pineapples?
Obviously there's a local market here in the territory, particularly Darwin. But the Australian market is the target market for the pineapples that we grow as a business. There's very limited export opportunities on pineapples because Australia is some of the highest cost farm labour in the world, so we're very expensive producers compared to our competition, which in the tropics is third world countries, so Indonesia, Thailand, Philippines, etc. At a fraction of our labour costs. Mm. So very limited export opportunities. However, the Australian public love Australian pineapples. So from here in the territory, we'll focus on the territory initially, and any surplus will then head down the track to Adelaide and across to Perth because we have freight advantages out of here compared to Queensland for those markets, yeah.
Land options right across the north of Australia. Why choose Darwin?
With all horticulture, it's labour-intensive. You need people, you need infrastructure, you need cool rooms, transport, that type of thing. So Northern Australia is not endowed with a lot of infrastructure in that space. Because of pineapples, even though they're tropical, they don't like excessive heat. So anything over about 38 degrees, they really start stressing. They get sunburnt. The plant himself sunburns over about 38. So hence that keeps you closer to the coast. Mm. When you're further inland, it gets above 38 pretty quickly. They also don't like it below about 15 degrees either. So when you look at that 15 to 35 ideal temperature for pineapple, Darwin fits the bill. It's got infrastructure. It's a progressive place. It's got a population base to attract workers. And it's also got a local market, which helps, on the shoulders ends of your harvest.
This will be the first commercial plantation of pineapples in the territory, is that right?
I believe so. Well, certainly for a while anyway, Matty. There's no other commercial operations in in the territory at the moment, and hasn't been for a while, but I have heard that back 20, 30 years ago there were a few operators in the Humpty Doo area, so I don't know of them, but certainly at the moment and for the last 10 years or so, it's the first commercial one, yeah.
That's the Managing Director of Pinata Farms, Gavin Skurr. You're with Country Breakfast on RN. I'm Tony Allen, and we're looking at the challenges of farming in Australia's top end. And those challenges are magnified, of course, if you're a working mother juggling employment and looking after children. And when you run a remote farm and you have a sick child, that balance gets even tougher. Kaylin Fletcher from Kununurra in the far northwest of Western Australia told Lucy Barber how she keeps it all together.
I've got a very supportive husband and a supportive mother and mother-in-law. So, for instance, to come to this conference, my husband and mother are helping look after the two older boys. I flew my mother-in-law over from Brisbane to help look after the baby, and I've ducked out twice now to go and tend to the baby and feed him. And my family is really important to me. I'd never say I'd rather be out working and not be with them, but I don't want to give up working either. I enjoy it. You know, I went to university to study it, and I want to be part of the future in the ag industry up here. And so, you know, the children, hopefully they'll be involved as well. And I take them out to pick onions or
not the baby though.
Oh yes, he's been out there. He can sit up now, so he sits on the edge of the paddock while we look at different things, and he drives around and checks crops with me very regularly. I think it's wonderful.
Do you ever have moments though when you just think, look, enough's enough, I just want to throw it all in, I'm exhausted?
Yes. Unfortunately the baby has been quite sick this year. He was diagnosed with a rare neurological disorder, so it was really challenging and trying to, you know, while we're in hospital with him in Perth, you know, you're still trying to run a business and away from the other kids, and, you know, you're still, like, wanting to tend to the baby and still trying to make business decisions, and you think, God, I don't care about that business decision, but, you know, you've got to be realistic, and in a couple of weeks' time I'm going to need to care about that business decision, otherwise I might not have a business there. But I think it grows resilience, you know.
I'm getting the impression that your families obviously had to be very, very close and supportive of each other through such a really difficult time. How have you managed to do that? What are the keys to keeping it together and not losing it?
I work very closely with my father. So he and I sort of manage the business, and he's never once ever said to me, oh, you need to be here at this time, or the baby's making too much noise, or anything, you know. So the kids, particularly the baby now, come to work with me all the time, and he's really supportive, and I think he enjoys it. I think I look back at the last 10 years that I've worked with my father, and I go, I've enjoyed them, and I'm blessed that I've been able to be involved with him every day.
And what's the future going to look like for you guys, for your family and for your farm business? What do you hope to achieve?
It's getting easier every day, you know, a little bit more successful, and we're getting a lot more interest from other companies and better contracts, and I think my father would probably like to slow down a little bit, but I'm not ready for him to step out yet. And I think that's probably the opposite to most people say in succession planning in Australia. His knowledge base is amazing. And
how old is he?
He's a bit over 70, so he's probably well due to be able to slow down. But we never argue. I enjoy working with him. But my brother's looking at coming back into the business now, so that is the succession planning starting.
And we see these romantic images of top-end farms and sunsets, beautiful sunsets and so forth. When you get home to the farm, and what is it, what's the image that you see day to day that makes you think, this is why I do it?
We do own a rum distillery as well, and so I like to have a nice cold order of a rum while we watch the sunset. And look, and it normally involves a bit of noise. I love hearing the kids in the background. I've got three boys, so it is rather noisy. And I've got two older sisters, and they've all got kids in Kununurra. So to me, if we're sitting on the deck at the house having a rum, there's normally about 15 or 18 of us. So it's a lot of noise. It's not serene, but it's often a good view, and it's, to me, really good times.
Kaylin Fletcher from the RB Desert Seed Company at Kununurra in far north Western Australia. She was one of the guests at the recent Food Futures Conference in Darwin. Lucy Barber and Matt Brand were our reporters. I hope you've enjoyed Country Breakfast this morning, thanks to our technical producer, Kerry Dell. And why not subscribe to our podcast so you can listen in at any time? Head to abc.net.au/rural. I'm Tony Allen. Goodbye for now.